Hello from Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Moya Dodd.
And I'm Matt Rubenstein, and this is The Competitive Edge, what you need to know about competition law in Australia and around the world.
Today, chilling effects. Anne Catherine Fay, the economist and counsel to the chair of the American Bar Association's antitrust section, joins us to talk about antitrust, economics, and sustainability.
Within the antitrust law section, I don't think any of us could escape the growing debate about whether the current U.S. antitrust laws provide for a chilling effect on efforts towards environmental sustainability. So it was only timely that under the leadership of Fiona, we raised even further this debate on the intersection of competition law and environmental sustainability.
So antitrust laws have a chilling effect on efforts that are meant to have a chilling effect, or at least a not warming quite so quickly effect.
Yeah, these chilling effects could well have warming effects.
Oh, they're blowing hot and cold. It's like the Melbourne weather. But first, Matt, what's been happening around the grounds?
Well, starting in the US, the Department of Justice has just filed a historic antitrust complaint against Apple. It says that for many years, Apple has monopolized or attempted to monopolize smartphone markets by locking in customers and locking out competitors.
This is about the green bubbles, isn't it?
It is partly about the green bubbles and the other ways that Apple has allegedly made it harder for competitors to win over Apple customers and harder for Apple customers to even think about switching.
So this sounds a bit like the DOJ's case against Microsoft back in the year 2000, when the Matildas played in the Olympics for the first time, by the way, in Sydney, of course.
That's right. In the upcoming Paris Olympics, we're playing Germany first, like we did back then, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we'll do better this time.
Yeah.
But have we drawn the group of death yet again, Moya?
No, I call it business as usual for the Matildas these days. They're all pretty tough groups.
I guess they are. So the DOJ isn't being shy about placing the Apple action among the great antitrust cases of the past, from Standard Oil to AT&T, and of course the Microsoft case, which they're saying now kind of led us to where we are today, as Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Kanter says.
Approximately 25 years ago, the Department of Justice, State Attorneys General, announced a case against a different platform monopolist. That successful litigation and remedy created opportunities for the next generation of technologies, including and especially Apple. Apple itself was a significant beneficiary of that case. And the remedy paved the way for Apple to launch iTunes, iPod, and eventually the iPhone.
So we should have been calling them DOJ phones all this time?
It is pretty catchy. But this could be a bit of revisionist history, or as I say these days, a retroactive continuity or retcon.
Ready, see? Like when Harold came back to Neighbours with amnesia 5 years after he was meant to have drowned?
Yeah, or when they kept moving the third Fast and Furious film forward in the timeline so they could have three more movies with Han, even though we'd just seen him die in a fiery car accident, which later it turned out wasn't an accident. He was killed by Jason Statham. And even later it turned out he wasn't even killed. What? He faked his own death with the help of Kurt Russell.
Oh dear. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been too long. So it's not clear exactly how much Apple benefited from the Microsoft remedies. But the year after the Microsoft case was decided did see the release of iTunes, the iPod, and the first film in the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, so we're blaming them for that as well?
Thanking them, surely. The DOJ now says that Apple has been using the same kind of strategies as Microsoft used against web browsers like Netscape back in the day. For example, they're alleging that Apple has restricted super apps like WeChat and cloud streaming services that would bundle a lot of mini apps or games together within one easily downloadable app.
Yeah, they're worried that those could become more important to the user than Apple's own ecosystem. A bit like Netscape, I suppose, might have become more important than Microsoft's operating system.
That's right. They also say that Apple has degraded other messaging apps by not letting them integrate carrier-based text messages, also by showing messages to non-Apple users in those sickening green bubbles instead of their far more pleasing blue bubbles, and only sending them low-quality images, as the Attorney General also says.
In 2022, Apple's CEO was asked whether Apple would fix iPhone to Android messaging. The questioner added, quote, "Not to make it personal, but I can't send my mom certain videos," close quote. Apple's CEO responded, "Buy your mom an iPhone."
Well, anything sounds bad when an attorney general says it, but it was clearly a joke, right? And what else is a CEO supposed to say?
Yeah, it's what Steve Jobs would have said, isn't it? The complaint also argues that the Apple Watch is able to integrate with the iPhone more seamlessly than other smartwatches can. And most importantly, at least for Andrew Lowe and me, it says that Apple is limiting other digital wallets by preventing developers, especially banks, from providing their own tap and pay services to their customers.
Oh, wow. Do you think the DOJ was listening to that episode?
The timing was suspicious, I thought. The complaint also tries to head off Apple's argument that all of these restrictions are aimed at privacy and security. And it says that Apple's only concerned about those things when it suits them. Otherwise, it's quite happy to compromise. Like when it makes Google Search its default search engine, even though, the DOJ says, more privacy-focused options are available.
And they've got a separate action going against Google for monopolizing internet search, including by paying Apple to be its default search engine. So is that a bit of a foul off the ball?
I think it is a bit. The Attorney General then wraps up with a kind of joke of his own.
Apple has maintained its power, not because of its superiority, because of its unlawful exclusionary behavior. Monopolies like Apple's threaten the free and fair markets upon which our economy is based. They stifle innovation. They hurt producers and workers, and they increase costs for consumers. If left unchallenged, Apple will only continue to strengthen its smartphone monopoly. But there's a law for that.
Feels like he's waited a long time to say that. And he didn't mind waiting a bit longer either.
Yeah, I might have gone with there's an act for that. But maybe that's why he's the Attorney General and I've just got a podcast.
Yeah, so how do we like the DOJ's chances here?
Well, it's interesting that they haven't gone the epic route, which is to argue that Apple's products are in their own market. Instead, they're talking about the whole US smartphone market, where by the DOJ's numbers, Apple has about a 65% share of revenue, or 70% of performance smartphones, if that's a relevant submarket.
Well, the US courts have said it's unlikely that a market share less than 70% will be a monopoly. So Apple's share is right on the line at best.
Yeah, and other figures out there have Apple at more like 55%. So there'll be an argument about that, you'd think. The DOJ is also alleging attempted monopolization, where you just need a dangerous probability of getting monopoly power. And Apple's share has ticked up by about 10 percentage points over the last decade. And the DOJ also says that it's much higher among teenagers, up to 85% in that group.
Ah, so I guess if their lock-in strategies are working, they may be looking at a dangerous probability of something like a monopoly in the future.
Yeah, I think it'd still take a bit of a departure for the court to side with the DOJ on that question, but it's not impossible. I mean, you could argue that the traditional reliance on market shares doesn't give you the whole picture in these complex new industries.
And some of this conduct is a bit subtle, isn't it? Like using different colours for certain messages. It's not like burning down your competitor's factory or it's jumping Castle Warehouse.
It's not. But the argument is that all these things together add up to damaging your competitors. And we are looking at more subtle things these days. It's like dark patterns, where it's an argument about the size and colour and placement of a word or a phrase, which can end up making a real difference.
Indeed. And how's Apple going back here in Australia?
Well, the Fortnite case has just kicked off here, with opening statements from Epic's lawyers, starting with Neil Young, not that one, who had a go at Apple for abusing its monopoly in iOS app distribution.
And this is where they're arguing Apple has its own market.
Yeah, and here Epic says that Apple customers generally wouldn't switch to Google in response to a modest change in price or quality.
Uh-huh, so this is the snip test of whether customers would switch to another supplier if there's a small but significant non-transitory increase in price, like 5% increase for a year.
Yeah, there's also the small but significant non-transitory decrease in quality test, or, I don't know, Cindy Q?
Cindy Q, I like it. Is that our latest candidate for word of the year?
It's at least as good as Cozy Lives, I reckon.
I reckon.
And it's especially useful when the product is supplied at zero cost but is supported by advertising, for example.
Yeah, that puts quality rather than price into focus, doesn't it? But everything gets more complicated when we're dealing with multi-sided markets like we have here.
It sure does. So still acting for Epic, Gary Rich argued that Google had used its position as a dominant or virtual monopoly supplier of Android apps, together with a network of contractual arrangements to stifle competition.
Yeah, we kind of think of Apple as closed and maybe more rigid, and Google as more flexible, including because Android is open source. But these contractual arrangements mean that if you want to offer Google's core services on a handset, like everyone does, you actually have to accept a lot of the same restrictions as Apple would impose.
Yeah, that is the argument. And both Apple and Google would say that all those restrictions help improve privacy and security for consumers. But Ruth Higgins, also acting for Epic, came in to deal with those claims.
Yeah, and she argued that recent experience with the Digital Markets Act in Europe showed that both Apple and Google could make their systems more open while still claiming a very high level of security.
That's right. Finally, the class action lawyers did their bit. They said that they could be representing up to 150,000 developers and potentially 15 million Australian consumers. And we'll hear from Apple and Google when the trial continues.
I'm sure we will. What else is going on?
Well, there's been another disappointment for the ACCC's cartel program, because the full federal court has just overturned the ACCC's win against construction company Hutchinson, or Hutchies, and the CFMEU, or the CFMMEU, as it was at the time of the original proceedings.
So the CFMEU is one of the big trade unions in Australia. It was the Construction, Forestry, Mining and Energy Union. But in 2018, it merged with the Maritime Union and became the CFMMEU.
Yeah, then in 2023, they decided that was just too hard to say. So the Maritime Division split off again and took the Energy Division with it.
Yeah, so now we're back to the CFMEU, although that stands for the Construction, Forestry and Maritime Employees Union now.
That's right. In 2016, Hutchies was head contractor for the South Point development in Brisbane, actually not far from where Kingsley's Steak and Crab House used to be.
Sounds like the place to be. And the union representing most of the workers was the CFMMEU. That is hard to say.
It is. Hutchies had hired a waterproofer that the union didn't like, and the union said it would sit the job down if that waterproofer ever came on site again.
What, sit it down and give it a good talking to?
I assume that's what they meant. Hutchies then hired a different waterproofer, and the ACCC took civil proceedings against Hutchies under the secondary boycott provisions and against the union for being knowingly concerned.
So I had a look at the secondary boycott provisions and, well, they might be the only part of the Act that actually give the criminal cartel prohibitions a run for their money in terms of prolixity and complexity.
They do. Like Section 45D prohibits a person in concert with a second person from preventing a third person from dealing with a fourth person.
Wasn't that a Marx Brothers routine?
I'm pretty sure it was. But this was under Section 45E, which says basically that Hutchies can't agree with a union that it'll stop acquiring services from a supplier, like a waterproofer.
And the trial judge said that's exactly what Hutchies did, and Her Honour imposed civil penalties of $600,000 on Hutchies and $750,000 on the CFMEU.
Yeah, but in February this year, the full federal court disagreed. They said there wasn't enough evidence of an arrangement or understanding between Hutchies and the union. There wasn't that meeting of the minds that you need. There was a threat of industrial action, and Hutchies had acted to avoid that, but that was just parallel conduct and not an arrangement or understanding.
So wasn't there at least an attempt to induce an arrangement or understanding?
Well, the full court said no. Maybe the union made the threat hoping to achieve a certain result, which it did, but that wasn't an attempt to reach an understanding. As the court said, helpfully, each party must understand that they are reaching an understanding, and a party cannot commit to do something without being aware of it being done.
That has to be a Marx Brothers routine.
The other thing to note is that Justices Bromwich and Anderson abbreviate the Competition and Consumer Act as CCA, like I think most people do. But Justice Wigney likes to call it the C&C Act. And I think that's because he's a fan of C&C Music Factory from the late 80s and early 90s.
Ah, things that make you go, hmm.
Hmm. And the ACCC has just applied for special leave to appeal to the High Court, so we'll see what happens there.
Of course, employment arrangements are exempt from most of the competition provisions of the Act, but not the secondary boycott provisions, or the resale price maintenance provisions for some reason.
Yeah, and that exemption has been interpreted pretty broadly, and it may have to be revisited now that the government's getting interested in no-poach and non-compete agreements.
Yeah, it's different to places like the US where they don't have the same history of industrial relations, and the DOJ's been going after no-poaching agreements for years.
Yeah, including a complaint that it settled against Apple, Google and some other tech companies back in 2010.
Hmm. And while we're in America, our own Anna Belgiorno-Nettis recently spoke with Anne Catherine Fay, who's an economist at Analysis Group and also counsel to the chair of the ABA's antitrust section, Fiona Schaefer, who's originally from Adelaide, by the way.
Yeah, we almost overlapped at law school, but not quite. Anne Catherine had a lot to say about the way economists and lawyers might approach sustainability issues differently, and how the US has an especially complicated landscape when it comes to the antitrust treatment of environmental collaborations.
Let's take a listen.
I'm feeling especially fortunate today to be sitting here with Anne Catherine Fay to discuss all things environmental sustainability in competition law, consumer law, but most of all, economics. So, Anne Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Anna. Thank you so much for the invitation.
To begin, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background, especially in relation to the ABA's antitrust section. And it's especially noteworthy here to point out that you're the first economist to serve in that important position of counsel to the chair, which really speaks to the critical role that economics plays in competition and consumer law. So could you walk us through how you came to have that position?
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, I am an economist by training and in practice at Analysis Group. And in my world of economic consulting, I work directly with lawyers to offer economic expertise, often in a litigation context involving antitrust questions. So given how economic analysis is prevalent in competition and consumer protection issues, it is only natural that economists have been active within the ABA antitrust law section for decades, really. In my case, I was already serving as a vice chair in a committee when I met then-chair-elect Fiona Schaefer. I'm grateful that she bet on me, the first economist to fill this council role, which has traditionally been held by a lawyer, to work closely with the chair on really all facets of leading the ABA antitrust law section.
And what do you think you've brought to the role that as an economist you're able to bring and a lawyer might not be so well placed to?
I think for me, you know, when I started, I just remember being in several meetings with a crowd of all lawyers, only lawyers. And as an economist, I came in asking lots of questions, really testing assumptions. And I think at first that was a lot of fun, pushing people to rethink how they were operating. How can we do things differently, more efficiently? How can we bring in more people, more voices, different voices?
How did you become interested in this intersection of competition law and economics with environmental sustainability?
Well, Anna, I have to say, first, out of concern for our planet as a citizen of the world, really. And second, as an economist, learning about the massive scale of resources required to fight climate change, which is, in my view, a call for action to better understand resource allocation issues, coordination among businesses, including perhaps competitors, and ultimately consumer harm and protection. So that clearly sparked my interest at a personal level. But I would say within the antitrust law section, I don't think any of us could escape the growing debate about whether the current U.S. antitrust laws provide for a chilling effect on efforts towards environmental sustainability. So it was only timely that under the leadership of Fiona, we raised even further this debate on the intersection of competition law and environmental sustainability.
Could you talk us through what you see as the tension between competition law on the one hand and sustainability initiatives on the other?
Yes. On one hand, there is this understanding that pursuing sustainability initiatives will be expensive and require collaboration among businesses to effect meaningful and broad change. On the other hand, antitrust laws ban any collaboration among competitors that lead to lower output, lower quality, higher prices, or less innovation. At a high level, the tension comes from the fact that wide-scale collaboration is required to fight climate change, but there are legitimate reasons to prohibit anti-competitive interactions. And different types of conduct in the context of pursuing sustainability initiatives can raise antitrust concerns, such as the sharing of sensitive information, say on pricing or customer discounts. Group boycotts, meaning a collective decision by competitors to discriminate against suppliers who do not comply, say, with certain standards. Or, as a third example, the implementation of mandatory standards or certification that may block competitors. So I think, essentially, any cartel-like conduct among firms that pursue sustainability goals together can and will likely raise antitrust concerns.
Because of the economist's focus on data and these particular theories that you're able to look at through evidence, you are so conscious of the need to act on these questions of environmental sustainability. And at the same time, that framework is very conscious of the competition law problems that may come up and maybe not always entirely a realistic assumptions. Let's take, for example, the idea of the informed consumer and how that's necessary for workable competition and effective competition. You know, if we think about that idea of the informed consumer, particularly in an area where there is so much misinformation and misunderstanding around sustainable initiatives, What do you see as the economist's role in helping businesses navigate this landscape to follow and comply with their competition law responsibilities, but at the same time progress sustainability initiatives?
Yes. So economists can play different roles in this challenging environment for firms and really other stakeholders. You mentioned the role of debunking misinformation. This can take the form of scientific research, say on the intersection of sustainability and competition law. And as we've discussed earlier, economists are critical in evaluating anti-competitive behavior and its effects on markets and consumers. In addition, economists can help assess the effects and impact of sustainability initiatives for various groups, right? For instance, economists will quantify the benefits and costs of setting emission standards or emissions target at a national and a global level. You know, the role of economists can extend to various contexts. And in my day job, whether in a regulatory investigation or in a litigation involving businesses on matters relating to challenges to sustainability agreements, economic analysis has a critical addition to all the analysis that is ultimately presented in court or before regulators or out there in the public.
It's interesting on that point of misinformation, because here, if we shift to look at what the regulatory authorities are doing, in Australia, the ACCC has been very open to pushing for change, and that often has been through a consumer law framework around misleading and deceptive conduct. They have issued final guidance in December for businesses making environmental claims and outline 8 principles for trustworthy environmental claims for us all to learn from. They've also taken action against a local manufacturer in relation to claims that product packaging was made from 100% ocean plastic. So that's a good example of this focus on misleading and deceptive conduct. And then finally, we have more guidance to come. They've flagged that they're releasing guidance on emission and offset claims, as well as the use of trust marks, such as third-party certifications that have really come to the fore, and understanding how these fit in with lawful conduct and what is really needed to ensure you're not misleading. So that's a quick snapshot of the Aussie framework. But in the US, I know it's quite a different snapshot and a different picture. It seems that the authorities have been less certain on how to act. I actually remember at Spring Meeting, the flagship event of your antitrust section last year at the Enforcers Roundtable, in response to a question on sustainability guidance for business, the Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan replied, "We look at these deals through a competition prism, and any types of ESG commitments or other types of sustainability commitments are really not key to our inquiry." The Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, Gwendolyn Cooley, noted US states had very varied views on the issues. And my personal favorite reply came from the Assistant Attorney General for the DOJ's Antitrust Division, Jonathan Cantor, who simply said, "It's a fascinating discussion," and wouldn't say any more than that. So I'd be very interested, Anne Catherine, in how the landscape in the US around these antitrust and sustainability questions has evolved potentially since March last year.
Well, Anna, I'm afraid not much has changed, except perhaps that political views are even more prominent in the sustainability space. There is no single type of sustainability enforcement in the United States. The U.S. Congress and some state attorney generals have advocated for greater scrutiny of industry-wide sustainability initiatives, and other state AGs have argued that such initiatives are pro-competitive. So there's significant risk associated with sustainability collaborations, and firms considering these types of interaction can anticipate scrutiny from lawmakers and antitrust agencies. In fact, some politicians have made statements that ESG collaborations, which one can assume involve environmental sustainability initiatives, may violate U.S. antitrust laws and harm consumers. So, as you mentioned earlier, federal agencies have indicated that there are no ESG exemptions to antitrust laws. The states, in fact, have been taking a spectrum of positions from pro-ESG to against, adding to the complexity of the landscape in the US when it comes to sustainability. And this is all to say, Anna, that the landscape in the US for sustainability initiatives is complex and more challenging than the one you just described for Australia.
It's very interesting, given we often look to the US as the pioneering leader in initiatives that are progressing us further in each of our professional spaces. And so to think that they really have not taken this role this time is very interesting. So we've painted a picture of what the situation looks like at the moment in the US. And now perhaps if we shift to where we could be going with the two conferences at Howard University School of Law in Washington, DC, and then also at Oxford University in England, you held two panels on sustainability and competition law. Friends or foes? How did those two conversations go, and what were the takeaways from your perspective, Anne Catherine?
Well, Anna, those two conferences were wonderful. Beyond the great attendance, we've seen meaningful engagement from speakers as well as participants from the audience. I would say there were several takeaways worth highlighting. First, climate collaboration is not a new concept. There is a long list of business alliances in environment. A recent Harvard study co-authored by Professor Peter Tufano identifies over 150 alliances, most of which were active in narrow climate space. So this is not a new concept. It shouldn't be causing much uproar. Second, should antitrust laws be used to address climate inequality? Some communities, often disadvantaged communities, seem more vulnerable to climate change. There are both champions and opponents of how and whether antitrust law should be used for that purpose of aligning climate equality across various groups. And third, the push for sustainability initiatives may be slowed down or challenged by regulations or politics, but this push is unlikely to die. At the pace at which jurisdictions around the world are tackling environmental sustainability is quite different, but it is real and marching forward.
With our public benefits-based authorization framework here in Australia, we have seen environmental issues brought up various times, as you say, in relation to competition law, whether it's mergers or conduct. And on the climate inequality, I think this is just a growing debate, as you know full well, with your fantastic work with the OECD on gender inclusivity and competition law. I think that's just another angle of that conversation and who we are treating as the standard consumer in our competition law analysis. And then finally, as you say, this entire conversation started with a push from the public and the numerous stakeholders that are so focused on sustainability is really our number one global issue. I have a similar feeling to you that push comes to shove, this will only continue to grow in our competition law spaces. So to finish up, you've got your flagship spring meeting event coming up in April. What can we look forward to in this competition law and sustainability space at spring meeting and then also further?
We will have, among many others, two panels discussing antitrust and its relationship with environmental justice and ESG issues at our upcoming spring meeting antitrust law conference, which will be held in Washington, D.C. this year between April 10 and 12. We will keep contributing to this debate on the intersection of antitrust law and sustainability, one at an upcoming conference that we'll have near to you, Anna, in Sydney, Australia, sometime in August, and in South Africa, in Cape Town, in September 2024. So we're really excited and looking forward to those additional debates and discussions around these topics.
I so echo your excitement for the Sydney conversation and seminar in particular. And noting, of course, that the host of the seminar series is Marcus Betsy, who's the chief advisor of our competition task force that's undertaking a major overhaul review of Australia's competition laws. As you say, this is a global topic. So to be able to bring your section globally over to us here in Sydney will be very special. And Catherine, thank you so much for your time and for your exploration of this topic with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a great interview. Interesting that the US has been viewed as historically a bit laissez-faire when it comes to some kinds of antitrust enforcement, but it's always taken a harder line against labour and environmental arrangements.
Yeah, even now that the agencies over there are taking a more progressive approach in a lot of other areas.
And we'll certainly be looking forward to August. Last year, the World Cup. This year, we're hosting the ABA seminar series. But first, Matt, what are you seeing in your crystal ball?
There have been a few questions raised at the number and breadth of the market inquiries and studies that have been assigned to the ACCC lately. And some of those used to go to the Productivity Commission, or the Industry Commission as it then was.
And they might have had a broader view of things than the ACCC. A lot of issues in our market economy have competition and consumer protection elements, but they're not always the main elements and they're never the only elements.
That's right. And there can be benefits in having someone who's not the enforcement agency have a look at these things as well.
Yeah, especially when it comes to the roles that different agencies can or should play in tackling a particular problem.
Exactly. So it's interesting that the Treasurer has just asked the Productivity Commission to do a study on the impact of the new national competition policy, which has been developed by the Commonwealth, the states and the territories through the Council on Federal Financial Relations, or COFFER, as we probably have to call it.
Well, that seems like a good name for it. It's a kind of box for money, isn't it? Like a piggy bank?
Yeah, it's a very old word. It's in the Canterbury Tales, in fact.
With hetta sore, he goth unto his coffre, and brocht a gold unto this philosophre.
That wasn't you just then, was it?
No, that was the late actor Richard Bebb, who was one of the voices in the original production of Under Milk Wood, and later appeared with John Goodman in the comedy King Ralph.
And COFFER reports to the National Cabinet?
Yeah, it used to report into COAG, the Council of Australian Governments, before that became the NASHEC.
The NASHEC. And what does COFFER have in its coffers, or its philosophers?
Well, not much yet. Late last year, it agreed to progress competition-enhancing reforms by revitalising the national competition policy. It'll identify reform options by the middle of this year, and the Productivity Commission will then assess those options.
Are they going to include the ACCC's proposed merger reforms and things like unfair trading practices and consumer guarantees?
It may be too late for the merger reforms, but any changes to the CNC Act do have to be agreed by the states and territories, and they could benefit from the Productivity Commission's input on all those issues at some point.
Go the Prodi-C. And they've had different views from the ACCC and the Assistant Minister on things like concentration and competition, haven't they?
Yeah, so the commissioners listed for this inquiry are Deputy Chair Alex Robson and also Stephen King, not that one, but the former ACCC commissioner, who've both been a bit cautious about the need for changes to the merger processes.
Yeah, Alex Robson told the Economic Dynamism Inquiry last year that the Australian economy hasn't been getting more concentrated overall and that the ACCC should refine its internal processes rather than asking for a new formal regime.
Yeah, and in 2022, Stephen King wrote a piece with former ACCC chair Graham Samuel, where they argued that where the ACCC has lost contested merger cases, that's had more to do with its merger analysis and its litigation strategy than with the legal framework. And they've been critical of most, though not all, of the elements of the ACCC's proposal, as it was at the time.
And the Prodi-C chair, Danielle Wood, is on the advisory panel to the Competition Task Force, of course, so no doubt there'll be some good opportunities for the Commission's views to be heard on all these proposals.
Yeah, in the meantime, we're all waiting to see how the government responds to the merger reform recommendations, which by most accounts were sent up the chain back in February.
Indeed. Well, remember, you can find relevant links in our show notes and email us at edge@gtlaw.com.au.
And we've got some great guests still to come, including GNT alum and now climate law guru at Columbia University, Romany Webb, on climate law and carbon dioxide removal, especially from the ocean, as well as Amelia McKellar on consumer guarantees and the changes the ACCC is arguing for. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell your friends.
Till next time, this was The Competitive Edge with Gilbert and Tobin.